Welcome to Our World on VOA. A weekly look at developments in human technology and natural science. I'm Roseanne Skirbel. Today, scientists discover the most distant object in the solar system. Museum goers have fun at the controls of robots like those now working on Mars. And a 17-year-old high school student wins the prestigious Intel Science Talent Search for his innovative work on cancer treatment. Do you have ownership of your idea?
I've applied for a provisional patent, so I'm starting the process.
A young mind with a promising future. That and the technological buzz over the protection of beehives, just ahead on Our World. Astronomers have discovered the most distant known object in our solar system. Researchers from the California Institute of Technology used the powerful telescope at Mount Palomar Observatory to find the very faint distant body currently orbiting the sun about 13 billion kilometers from Earth. That's three times further from us than Pluto. The most distant point in its solar orbit takes it 134 billion kilometers away from Earth. Scientists call the planet-like object Sedna, after a sea goddess in Native American mythology. It is the coolest, most distant object ever seen in orbit around the sun. Research team leader Michael Brown says scientists were surprised to find it in such a remote and distant region of our solar system.
And we believe that the fact that this object is here is evidence that there are many, many objects in this region that we'll be finding in the future. And all of these objects, we think, were put in place in the very earliest history of the solar system when the sun was formed in a very big cluster of stars. And so we think we're seeing the fossil remnant of the early solar system.
And how did you first detect it?
We've been doing a survey of the outer solar system looking for very large objects for about the past 2.5 years. And we systematically go across the sky, look in different regions, and we first found this one on November 14th of 2003. And the way we knew that it was a distant object in the solar system is you take three pictures of the sky, you look at those pictures, stars, galaxies, everything else far away stays stationary, and objects in the solar system move. So we saw very slow motion across the sky of this object, and we instantly knew that it was something very, very far away, and we got excited.
What does it look like?
Well, to us, at this point, all we can see is one little spot of light moving across the sky. But from that spot of light, we've inferred many different things. First off, we've inferred that it's very red. It's one of the reddest objects in the solar system. We've inferred also that it's very reflective on the surface, almost as if it has ice on the surface. And yet ice shouldn't be red. So we're not entirely clear on what's going on the surface of it. We also know that if you're standing on the surface, it's so far away that the sun is just a very, very distant point of light that you could block out with the head of a pin held at arm's length. So it would be a very alien, cold, frigid place to be, not a place I'd want to spend too much time.
How can you continue to study this object, and what are some of the secrets that you hope that this object, this planet-like object, will reveal?
There are a couple different things that we want to understand about this particular object. To me, right now, the most important one is to understand whether it has a satellite. We think there's evidence that there's a little moon around it, but we haven't seen the moon yet. The best way to tell that is to use the Hubble Space Telescope and take a very detailed picture and see if it's there. We should be doing that in the very near future, and we're excited to see what happens. The other thing is to continue studying it with some of the largest telescopes on the Earth, including the Keck Telescope, the Gemini Telescope, and try to understand more about the surface of it. Also, what we're very excited to do is to continue the survey that we're doing of the sky and see if we can't find more objects like Sedna. The more we can find in this region of space, the better we understand how they got there, and the better we understand the very earliest history of the solar system.
Thank you very much for joining us on Our World.
It was my pleasure.
California Institute of Technology astronomer Michael Brown, speaking with us from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Sedna will get closer and brighter over the next 72 years before it begins its 10,500-year trip to the farthest reaches of the solar system. The last time Sedna was this close to the sun, the Earth was just coming out of its last ice age. Since they landed on Mars nearly 3 months ago, the twin robot geologists, Spirit and Opportunity, have done what they were designed to do. They have found evidence that water once drenched the planet, and they continue to traverse the rock-strewn landscape in search of more clues to the planet's ancient past. Meanwhile, in a basement workshop of the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, research assistant Emily Hamner sorts through piles of heads, necks, wheels, and electronic body parts. Ms. Hamner oversees the construction of 24 personal exploration rovers, a small-scale version of the robots currently deployed on Mars. None of these robots will ever make it to the Red Planet. The goal of the NASA-funded project is to put personal exploration rovers into museum exhibits and schools to excite young people about science and to educate the general public about robotic technology.
Robots are tools to do scientific exploration, and so the robot itself isn't the science, but what it can do. You need a robot that has some autonomy, some smarts on it.
Ms. Hamner holds a rover in her lap like a dog. This particular puppy has a camera mounted on its head and uses an optical rangefinder to keep from bumping into things.
They're designed so that you can tell which way they're looking when they turn their head up and down. We actually wanted them to look a little bit like an animal or like something that you could see that it has intention when it's doing something. So it has a small head that can pan and tilt. It has wheels. 6 wheels, 4 of them have motors, and it has this fun rocker bogey system here. So the wheels are all independent and can move independently, helps it climb over things. And inside, you can open it up and see it has
nice.
Its battery inside, all of the boards that run it, wireless card that we use to communicate with it.
How are these robots like the robots that are exploring Mars?
These robots are a lot like the ones exploring Mars. All the wheels are independently controlled, so it can do some interesting things, like it can drive the same way your car would drive forward and backwards, but then it can also turn its wheels sideways and drive in a straight line sideways. They also have the pan-tilt head, same as the Mars rovers do, so they can take a 360-degree panorama. We have this pretend solar panel, where the Mars rover has a real solar panel. Some differences, obviously the size, completely different. The speed is about the same. It goes about 4 centimeters per second.
Emily Hamner has already sent 12 personal exploration rovers to museums in several U.S. cities. On this day, one of those rovers crosses a walled Marscape in an exhibit at the National Air and Space Museum in Washington. Education Director Stephen Williams briefs a group of high school students from Fort Myers, Florida, before they take over the controls.
The mission for our visitors is to specify the target for the rover to go investigate. For life. You set the target, and the rover will take it from there.
The rover is directed to cross the rocky terrain, but it must also avoid obstacles, come to a stop at a specific rock, and flash its ultraviolet light for signs of simulated life.
Now it's taking a picture, and we'll see the overprint. If we see any purple glow, we've had a success. Pretty please? Yeah, there's some. All right. That's what it's all about. We're ready for the next driver. Step right up.
I'm going to try to go to that headless guy right there, the headless snowman or whatever it's called. So I want to try that.
How do you like having your hands on the controls of a rover?
It's fun. It's just something to do. It's something interactive.
Good aiming. You're aimed right at it. And there it is. You can see it in the distance coming towards you.
Right now it just found the rock and it's going to try to analyze it to find life.
Well,
and there's life. So that means I think I did it right.
Air and Space Museum Education Director Stephen Williams makes the most of the few minutes he has in the Mars yard before the students race to explore other museum attractions.
Our goal isn't to provide a lot of factual knowledge to our visitors. Our goal is to show them something that they'll find intriguing, make the subject seem interesting, so that when they go away, they'll be motivated to learn on their own, because that's when true learning takes place, and that's the most important objective of this activity.
Stephen Williams says the exhibit will coincide with the Mars rover mission. Scientists say that mission, which was only expected to last 90 days, will continue for as long as batteries hold out or until dust buildup on the solar panels prevents energy collection.
So these things have to have a lot of autonomy. You tell them where to go, and they have to be able to get there on their own, just like this rover can do. And they have enough sense to recognize hazards, and if we're trying to get it to do something it's not comfortable with, it will stop and ask for more detailed instructions.
As the pollination season begins for almond growers in the United States, beekeepers are getting record fees to move their hives into an orchard for a month or so and let the creatures do what they do naturally. But there's a downside. The increasing value of bees, not only for pollination but also for honey, has made the insects attractive to thieves. As Bob Hensley reports, beekeepers are turning to technology for help.
As the sun peeks over the horizon on a chilly February morning, Gene Brandy's using a forklift to unload a couple of dozen beehives from a flatbed truck in an almond orchard in California's Central Valley.
Each colony on this particular load is two boxes.
Mr. Brandy says business is good for beekeepers. A shortage of the insects has driven pollination fees to an all-time high.
This year, I think the average will be over $50 a colony, and I've heard rumors that some people are getting up to $60 a colony. 5 or 6 years ago, it would have been in the mid-40s.
But as pollination fees and honey prices have risen in recent years, so has the number of thefts. Beekeeper Orrin Johnson returned to an orchard just over a year ago to find all the hives he left there were gone.
The hives themselves were worth $6,000 to $7,000, and the lost revenue was probably $3,000 to $4,000 from pollination fees.
Because bee thieves know the business, Detective Giles New says it's difficult to catch them.
Most hive movement takes place at night because the bees are dormant. So as a result, you have numerous trucks prior to blossom season running around through the night delivering hives to various locations. Pretty difficult for law enforcement and off-site rangers to keep track of who's coming and going from the property.
Beekeepers may not be able to prevent thieves from stealing their hives, but they're turning to technology to help locate them if they're stolen. This is the sound a microchip makes when a programmed wand passes over it. A Los Angeles company, Avid, is one of a few manufacturers producing a microchip designed specifically for beehives. Company spokesman Dan Knox says the chip containing the owner's name, address, and telephone number is embedded in a hive.
This all fits inside of a little glass bead about the size of a grain of rice.
Another high-tech tracking device comes from the University of Montana at Missoula. Researchers there have developed technology similar to the UPC barcode that appears on grocery items and other retail products. Professor Jerry Bromenshank says the information on their electronic strip can be received by specially designed equipment as far away as 30 meters, and it's more easily hidden than a microchip.
We're working with beekeepers and with the bee equipment suppliers to start incorporating them into the hive. We've done all the tests and it shows it's working.
Detective Giles News says something similar to a global tracking device enables law enforcement to find stolen hives from the air.
We'll take selective hives from selected ranchers who have had problems in the past, put a few of these chips in their hives, then if in fact they're stolen, we can take a plane up and start searching the area.
The problem with microchips, barcodes, and aerial tracking is that they're expensive, especially for the small to moderate-sized operations that comprise the bulk of California's beekeeping industry. Like most in the business, Gene Brandy doesn't want to go into detail about what he's doing to secure his hives, but he speaks glowingly of high-tech methods. He expects the number of beekeepers employing tracking technology to grow as it becomes more sophisticated and less costly. For Our World, I'm Bob Hensley in Ceres, California.
The Intel Science Talent Search, the oldest and most prestigious high school science competition in the United States, named its top young scientists this week. First prize and a $100,000 college scholarship went to 17-year-old Massachusetts high school student Herbert Mason Hedberg for his creation of a faster, more efficient method to diagnose cancer. We caught up with the aspiring research physician in VOA's New York studio. Herbert, congratulations on your award. Let's talk a little bit about your project. Say you were talking to fellow students on your high school swimming team. How would you explain the experiment to them?
All right, well, I worked with an enzyme called telomerase, and telomerase is found almost exclusively in cancer cells. And in cancer cells, it allows these cells to be immortal, so it lets them divide forever. And it's been proven that telomerase inhibitors, so molecules that stop this enzyme, can be very powerful tumor suppressors. They actually cause the cancer cells to commit suicide. So for my project, I developed a telomerase assay, a process that can measure the activity of telomerase and determine whether or not certain molecules are telomerase inhibitors, which could be a future cancer therapy.
How did you get interested in telomerase?
Well, my grandmother had cancer in the base of her spine, and she needed two 12-hour operations to remove the tumor. And this got me reading about alternative and experimental cancer therapies, and telomerase is one of the areas I read about.
What does this add? What does this add to our understanding of what telomerase inhibitors are and what they do?
Well, the major advantage of this, of my project, is the speed at which telomerase inhibitors can be identified. I mean, we have a pretty thorough understanding of what a telomerase inhibitor would do when it is found, but the problem is we have trouble finding them. I think there are only two telomerase inhibitors right now going through FDA, so the drug approval. And I mean, we need several more in order to find one that can be used for several different types of cancer, kind of the universal cancer drug. Telomerase is expressed in over 80% of all cancer types. So theoretically, the ideal telomerase inhibitor would be a cure for almost 80% of all cancers. So this assay I developed is much, much faster than what is being used now. So it can screen, if this process is adopted by a drug company, it could test 50,000 compounds a month for their ability to inhibit telomerase.
How did you go about doing the experiment?
When I really got the idea for the project, there wasn't much more to do for the theory base, because it was a pretty simple idea to begin with. But where it got complicated is actually getting the telomerase enzyme. I needed to test my assay idea. And I used what's called in vitro gene expression. So I'm causing the DNA for the telomerase enzyme to be expressed. I'm making the protein from the DNA in a test tube, which is normally done deep inside cells, and it's a very complex process. So I was able to create and purify the telomerase enzyme, and then I could use it to prove my assay concept.
Now, before your grandmother got sick, mm-hmm. what did you know about telomerase enzymes?
Absolutely nothing. The first time I read about it was in a small article, and then I just kept reading, and I have a pretty good understanding about the enzyme now.
What is the potential of this kind of research?
Well, in mouse models, there's been tests at Geron Corporation. I think they're located in California, and they've used mouse models, skin tumors in mouse models too, and telomerase inhibitors in these models have completely eradicated the tumor with almost no side effects on the mouse. So it's a very exciting potential. And if you could find a small molecule telomerase inhibitor, which could be taken as a pill for humans, then hopefully the same results would be seen, almost no side effects, but complete elimination of the tumor.
What are your future plans, and do you expect that this research that you've done for the Intel Science Talent Search to be a part of it?
Well, because this is just a process that a drug company could use to find telomerase inhibitors, I hope to finish this up before I go to college next year and get it out into science. But this summer I have an internship at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute where I'm doing telomerase research but at a different stage in cancer development. And I find this fascinating. It's working on the role of telomerase in the progression of a normal cell becoming a cancerous cell. And I'd like to continue this type of research at Brown University while I'm going next year.
Do you have ownership of your idea?
I've applied for a provisional patent, so I'm starting the process.
You said that your grandmother inspired you to actually start with a project. How's she doing?
She was at the award ceremony last night, so it was a very nice experience.
Well, what was her reaction when she learned that you had come away with the top prize in the Intel Science Talent Search?
Well, there are actually very few words. My mom and my grandmother were both crying, and my dad and grandfather were there, too. They were smiling. I got handshakes. So it was very, very nice.
So what do you do for fun when you're not dreaming up projects to change the world?
Well, obviously, I have lots of friends at school, and I try to spend time with them every week, and I have I consider my biggest hobby besides swimming photography. I have a dark room in my basement I put together, and I try to spend some time doing that as well.
Thank you so much for coming in and speaking with us.
Well, thank you.
And good luck with your future plans.
Thank you.
Herbert Mason Hedberg, winner of the Intel Science Talent Search. He begins an 8-year medical program at Brown University in September. More than 2,500 finalists have been recognized in the talent search since the competition began in 1921. And that wraps up this edition of Our World. Thanks for listening. Address your comments to Our World, Voice of America, Washington, D.C., 20237 USA. Or send us an email note to ourworld@voanews.com. You can always catch up with us on the web at www.voanews.com/ourworld. The program editor is Rob Sivek. Eva Nenichka is the technical director. I'm Roseanne Skirbel. Join us again next week at this same time for another radio expedition into our world.